In the studio this morning, I have Jacob von Exkull from Germany, of Swedish origins, who has been involved in affirmative action for the last 30 years. In 1980, Jacob founded with his own resources the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, which is awarded each year in the Swedish Parliament in Stockholm. And since 1980, 133 people and organisations from 57 countries have been recognised in this way for their great commitment and selfless service amid great public interest. Prize winners of this wonderful award have devoted themselves to the causes of human rights, peace or conflict resolution, the rights of minorities, and the protection of the environment. In 2007, after many years' preliminary work, Jacob von Exkull also founded the World Future Council. The council comprises of 50 internationally known figures, including several winners of the Alternative Nobel Prize. They work as the voice of future generations to ensure that we pass on a healthy world worth living in to our descendants. Kia ora and welcome to New Zealand,
thank you.
Jacob.
Thank you.
Jacob, many years ago, back early 1980s, you had the idea of an alternative Nobel Prize. And this award is for people working on the coalface of social change. And I find it so compelling. Could you tell us how this evolved?
Well, I wrote to the Nobel Foundation because I was concerned. I grew up in a family where we always discussed, you know, problems, always looked for solutions. And I said, there are so many solutions in so many areas which need to be taken seriously. And how do you get taken seriously in the world today? Well, if you've grown up in Sweden, you know that if you get a Nobel Prize, then you get taken seriously. It's still the most famous international award. It was created as an international award in a time, you know, 100 years ago, which is still very nationalistic. So it's kept on growing, and it's quite clear that the Nobel Foundation made a sort of a marking about 30 years ago when they decided to introduce one new Nobel Award, not created by Alfred Nobel himself, namely one for economics. Now, that's a pretty remarkable decision. Why one for economics? Why not one for agriculture, but especially why not one for the environment? Why not one for the needs of the global south, for human development? You know, issues which obviously weren't there 100 years ago when Alfred Nobel created his awards. And I suggested this to the Nobel Foundation, and I thought in order that they'll take this seriously, because they probably get many, many letters every day, I decided to, I worked out if I sold my business, I could give them a substantial amount of money. It was then, you know, $1 million. I offered to contribute that. It wouldn't have kept this award going forever, but I thought they would take it seriously. I thought they would listen, that they would introduce an environmental Nobel Prize to sort of match the economics Nobel Prize. And to my surprise, they said, no, thank you. You know, we had decided this is it now, no more Nobel Prizes. And so by that time, I told so many people about this idea, and there was so much enthusiasm that I realized, you know, that this was the time, and I decided to start it myself. Of course, it's a much smaller award in money terms than the Nobel Prizes, because I was a dealer in rare postage stamps. That was my business, which is, of course, less profitable than inventing dynamite, which is what Alfred Nobel did. So, you know, I went to Stockholm, where I hadn't lived since I was 10 years old. I'd found two good award recipients. I announced this. I set up a press conference. And I announced these two recipients, and next day there was a serious discussion in one of the largest Swedish newspapers if this was a KGB plot or a CIA plot to discredit the Nobel Prizes, because it was quite unheard of that an individual had, you know, tried to do something like this. So next year they decided that there wasn't any plot, I was just some sort of crazy person. But one member of the Swedish Parliament, she believed enough in this, and she said, this award is so important, what you're doing, these kind of people are so important, this award should be presented in the Swedish Parliament. And she worked on her colleagues from different parties for 5 years, and after 5 years she said to me, I've succeeded. And so now, since 25 years, we present this award every year in the Swedish Parliament. Parliament has no influence over the way we pick our recipients. We have an international jury. Anybody can nominate anybody except themselves or their own organization. So it's a very open award. And as a result of that, we found out over the years what other issues there are. Of course, it still goes to very many environmental activists. It's very much an award for work in progress, not for great theories, not for people who are so established they need it, but for people where this award could really make a difference. And it does. We have honored human rights activists. And in one case, this was in Paraguay, in South America, this human rights lawyer told us, as a result of him getting this award, he was now so well established and credible in his country that he would be able to stop the ex-dictator from returning, as he had planned to do, out of exile. And in fact, you know, he succeeded, and the ex-dictator never returned.
Wonderful story, isn't it, really, to be able to use the grassroots to validate them so that they can shift.
It's great fun, and, you know, we get many exciting nominations every year. We don't get thousands, but, you know, we get 100, of which probably about 40 deserve the award. And some get money, sometimes we give an honorary award if they don't really need the money. The money which they share obviously has, you know, makes a difference, because quite often they have worked without any funding. But the most important thing, it gives them this credibility, the status, it opens doors, gets them taken seriously, it gives them protection. I think there are cases when we feel we've even saved lives. We certainly, you know, prevented people from being imprisoned, from being killed. Of course, what you have to do when you work at this interface of politics and civil society, it's quite a challenge, because we need the support of all the political parties in the Swedish parliament. If one of them sort of says we don't agree with this anymore, the speaker who hosts this would not be able to allow this award to be presented in parliament. So I have to work to make sure that everybody from the conservatives to the ex-communists are happy, at the same time to make sure that we don't compromise, that we still pick the kind of the really radical in the real sense of the term, you know, people who go to the root of the problem. And we've succeeded in doing this. And, you know, it's interesting that some years ago we had some problem with one of the parties, one of the conservative parties, and I went to them and pointed out that we've also honored people, you know, human rights activists in Russia, etc. And this speaker from the conservative party said, yes, I see there is a values community between us. And trying to build this values community across the normal, you know, left-right political spectrum, this has always been a challenge I've sort of enjoyed, because I feel the problems we now face are too serious. They're not going to be solved by one political grouping. We need to create new alliances, alliances for the planet, alliances for civilization, for humanity.
Yes, cooperation now is the only way for us to go. You also had some Nobel recipients as a result of awarding the alternative prize.
Well, we have had one so far. I always say there are many early warning systems and organizations dealing with early warnings, but you also need some early solutions. And I think this is what we provided. And so Wangari Maathai, the Kenyan environmentalist, actually won our award exactly 20 years before she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And there are other awards, for example, you know, there's a very well-endowed now award for energy, for future energy solutions, created by the government of Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, which was presented for the first time earlier this year in connection with this huge conference they have on Masdar, which is this eco-city they are building in near Abu Dhabi. And it was interesting to see that the two people they had picked, after using all their contacts and looking all over the world for their energy award, their future energy award, were both previous recipients of the Right Livelihood Award.
Ties it in nicely. And since then, you've moved over to the World Future Council. Of course, globally, all the challenges are now coming to meet us, particularly as we've got an ecological wave and a economic wave converging. And of course, the societal problems resulting from this are going to be huge.
I think we are in a situation now where we have basically one bad piece of news and three good pieces of news. The bad piece of news is very bad. I mean, the situation both in the environmental field, and of course that's the overriding field, you know, we cannot survive without a healthy environment. Nothing else will work. So we will not have peace, we will not have economic well-being if we've destroyed our natural environment, if we have destabilized it, as we are now doing with the climate. We are going to face war, conflict, mass starvation, the collapse of civilization. And what we're finding now is that the bad news are worse than even the pessimists assumed. I mean, years ago, I was on the board of Greenpeace. You know, I was a member of a green member of the European Parliament. And I must say, I did not predict that things would get as bad as they have, you know, by now. So that's the bad piece of news, is really bad. Now, the good piece of news is that the solutions are there. For basically every one of these challenges and problems we face, there are solutions available. And I know this, you know, through my work with the Right Livelihood Awards over the past 30 years. And the second good piece of news is that people are ready for big changes. And also I know this from my political work. I saw what happened, you know, when communism fell. I mean, when people feel that they are part of a larger movement, that they not just have to be dissidents, that they actually, the rules and regulations, the institutions of their society actually support what they're doing, people are ready for very big steps. It's a question of trust. If you've trusted leaders, almost anything is possible. And, you know, Winston Churchill, when fascism threatened kingdom, he changed society there within months. You don't need decades. You don't even need years. Things can happen very quickly. And I think the third good piece of news is what you just mentioned, that through this economic and financial crisis, the old system has lost its credibility to such an extent that there are now openings for drastic changes. And I looked at what is necessary, and I said one thing which is necessary is that our children and all future generations need a voice. They need an organization speaking up for their rights, for their interests. And interestingly enough, our ancestors had such institutions, although they could impact the future much less than we can today. In India, in pre-colonial India, they even called them councils of seers into the future. And in other civilizations too, there were similar institutions and principles. And today we don't have that. We are influencing the future much more than our ancestors. We don't have, so far, such a voice. So I said the World Future Council should be a body of respected individuals from all over the world who speak up for the needs and rights of future generations. And don't just pick that out of their personal preferences, but, you know, looks at what does science tell us, what do natural laws tell us, what is compatible with the future, what is future foreclosing, what are crimes and taboos against future generations, but also what are the solutions, what are the best policies, not just the best practice on an individual level, what I can do as a parent, as a consumer, as a producer, because however valuable that is, and it is very valuable that we can do to change our own lives, it's not going to be enough if the laws, the regulations, the institutions of our societies, the international agreements we are bound by, if they point in a different directions. Markets, which are often praised, the markets as supposed to provide solutions, markets are totally dependent on the political framework within which they operate. So if you have the right laws and rules and regulations, then markets can perform miracles and working in the right direction. But as long as you have the wrong legal framework, markets are going to move in the wrong direction. So I said we need the right policies. So the other main purpose of the World Future Council is to identify and help spread right policies. Now, where do you start? Well, you start with something which works in one country. For example, if you want to spread renewable energy in a country where there is a grid, which is about, you know, half the world's population are connected to the grid. Well, in Germany, you have so-called feed-in tariffs, where you provide a financial incentive, you provide a guaranteed income for people who install their own wind energy, solar energy installations, and sell them back to the grid, and the electricity companies have to pay them this fixed price, and the costs are spread across the whole population. And you have had such a rapid increase in renewable energy in Germany as a result of that, for example, they have about 15 times the installed wind energy capacity compared to the United Kingdom. But of course, the UK, being an island, has much more wind, but they have the wrong law. So we went in there and we provided a special website, provided advice to parliamentarians, and within 11 months, there was such a pressure on the government that they announced that they're going to change the law and introduce these feed-in tariffs. We've done the same thing in the USA, in South Africa, in Australia, and, you know, where there is no grid, which is the other half of the world's population, then you find another solution, which are freestanding so-called solar home systems funded by microcredits. So you take these solutions and then you work to spread them. You inform parliamentarians, we hold hearings with parliamentarians. And interestingly enough, this is through our close partnership with another organization called the e-Parliament. Small e, it stands for both for Earth and for electronic. This is a global network. This is a global network of all the world's democratically elected national members of parliament. So we hold these joint hearings with the e-Parliament. Interestingly, the Secretary General of the e-Parliament is also a member of the World Future Council. Nicholas Dunlop is a New Zealander. So we hold hearings in different parts of the world where they are informed about these best policies. We then work with these members of parliament in their respective countries, heads of energy committees, etc., to help to introduce this legislation. The last hearing we had on energy issues in South America, it was in Guyana, And interestingly enough, both the Prime Minister and the President turned up and attended the whole hearing. So people are realizing that this is really something which works because it provides them with a service. It provides them with solutions. It meets them where they are and helps them to improve the legislation of their country.
You mentioned Nicholas Dunlop. Can you explain a little bit about Nicholas and how he came to be involved?
Well, I've known Nicholas for many years. He is quite a remarkable New Zealander. He lived abroad for many years, of course, and he set up a parliamentary organization, now known as called Parliamentarians for Global Action. It had a different name when he set it up in the 80s. The 90s, he created an international network of non-governmental organizations, of civil society organizations called Earth Action. And then about the year 2000, he teamed up with a couple of people, especially a Harvard University professor and who works on conflict resolution called William Ury, who had this idea for this e-parliament, and Nicholas Dunlop is now the Secretary General of this global network. All these are basically comparatively small and underfunded organizations because most funders don't understand the importance of legal change. Martin Luther King once said that laws may not move the heart, but they restrain the heartless. And this importance of, you know, restraining the heartless, of overcoming the old, it's very easy to come up with new ideas. I get letters every day. People have new ideas, and they say, oh, you know, can't you promote them? But the problem is overcoming the old ideas, and, you know, we know how hard that is. And that needs legal change. That needs changing institutions. That needs changing the rules and regulations, etc. And that is not something which greatly excites funders. So organizations like this are always striving for funding because people don't understand, I think many people don't understand the importance of getting engaged in politics. They like nice things which are charitable, you know, you react, you save animals, you know, you try to sort of, you plant trees, which is great, it's very important. But without the right rules and regulations, without the right framework, it's all going to be too little too late. That's why we have to be get much more politically engaged, both in our funding this kind of work, but also in our personal activities. We need to create, why not create a future council in your own locality? You know, we need a New Zealand future council, we need an Auckland future council, and they can have very different formats. There are such institutions in some countries where there are sort of parliamentary subcommittees. But in other countries, these are civil society organizations which are looking at how can we create a sustainable city? What does it mean? What kind of changes do we need in the rules and regulations here? And they just work to increase their own power. Sometimes they have the government gives them a certain recognition. It's very difficult if you have an institution which has been created to make sure to protect your future. It's very difficult for the government to ignore it. As long as you make sure that you have, you know, credible individuals involved, as long as you make sure that you work with government, that you're not just seen as an anti-organization. So there are, in Switzerland, several of the cantons of the regions have created future councils now, which has some sort of semi-official status. And I think this is a great idea. We need local, regional, national future councils. We don't just need a world future council. But I was concerned with the global situation. I saw that there was this need for a global organization. And that is, I've been working on this level. I helped to create the New Economics Foundation in London. We need to also act globally. It's not enough to just to think globally. We also need to act globally because our opponents are acting globally. And their model of globalization, as the member of the World Future Council and the winner of the Right Livelihood Award, Vandana Shiva from India, said, what they call globalization is not what you would think that this word would mean, namely a sort of distillation of the interests of all the globe's peoples. It's actually the imposition of the interests of a small minority, of a small privileged minority on everybody else. And we need to counter that. You know, we need to protect the local globally. Otherwise, the local is always going to suffer from this global power structure. So we need to work on all levels.
For instance, if you had a group of people come together in Auckland, say, would they be just ordinary people and they just pool their skills together, or would you have to have an understanding of law?
Well, I mean, certainly once you start working on legal issues, it's always good to have legal expertise. But, you know, there's these community organizers in England who once said that, as far as they were concerned, the experts should be on tap, not on top. Don't say, oh, we have a huge problem, so you find an expert and they say, please take over and tell us what the solution is. You define the problem and then you call in the expert and say, we'd like an answer to these questions. This is outside our area of expertise. We don't understand this. Could you please tell us the answer? And then you say, they give you the answer, you say, thank you very much. And you send them away, and you work with that. And when you hit the next problem where you need expertise, you call in another expert and say, ask for the answer, and then once you've understood that, you work further. So I think the answer is you need access to expertise, but you don't need a body led by lawyers. You know, we provide the World Future Council. We have a special website for lawyers and for parliamentarians where they are told about laws in other countries, and they can put together the best, you know, law for their own country out of that. And we help them and advise them. And some of this is a legal issue, some is a political issue. I think every country, every city will probably have a different format depending on your links, you know, also with the political realm. I think the important thing is to realize that this is also something political. To me, non-governmental organizations are often a real problem, because if you start defining yourself in a negative, you know, we are non-governmental, then you're leaving out the whole political space. Why should we abdicate the political, the public space? You know, in ancient Greece, where democracy was created, the person who was politically engaged, who got involved in, actively in public life, was known as a politus. The person who refused to get engaged was known as an idiotus. And today people say, oh, you know, you must be an idiot to get involved in politics. But I know from my experience that, you know, I decided not to become a professional politician. But I spent one term in Parliament, in the European Parliament. It was invaluable. I learned to understand how politics works. And our opponents, the defenders of the status quo, the defenders of privilege, they understand and they make use of politics. And we often sit there as civil society and we make demands. And we then are surprised how, even when the politicians take them up, they get watered down and we are very unhappy with the final result. That's because we haven't been involved in the political process. So the most important message I have is we have to get politically engaged, otherwise it's not going to be enough.
And we have to be really, really sharp and alert.
Yeah, but you know, you have access to expertise. You can call in the expertise. The main thing is actually to be engaged, not to look down on politics. You know, I was in a panel with some businessmen where one of them announced that he'd been asked to be Minister of Economics of his state in Germany, and he turned it down. So he was quite proud of himself. He was non-political. I said, I think it's outrageous. I think you have a duty as a citizen. If you're asked to take up a position of political power, you have a duty to do it. And the other thing which we have to remember is, as the present system is losing credibility, which is now happening rapidly, we don't know how far this is going to go. We don't know when we are going to be called upon. I'm talking about all of us, your listeners, are going to be called upon to take power. And not just, you know, nationally, but locally, regionally. And this is exactly what happened in Eastern Europe. You know, when communism fell, the old system lost total credibility. People created round tables in every village, in every city, even nationally. And they called together civil society activists, but they also called together the local librarian who was trusted, the local teacher, the housewives. And these people suddenly had to take responsibility for their community, even for their region, even for their country. This may still happen when we see the speed which the current establishment, the current elite, are losing credibility, are losing trust, because, you know, they have, you know, we are ruled still by elites who for 30 years have sent out the wrong message. They are completely stuck in this old paradigm. You know, we must have economic growth at any price, and, you know, even at the expense of the planet, because if we don't have it, we're going to have a mass unemployment. But of course, if you destroy your environment, you're going to have even worse. You're going to have a collapse of society. You're also going to have a mass unemployment. So how can we move to an economy not completely dependent on this eternal growth? How can we make sure that the right things grow? We need new indicators of progress. There's much, much work that's being done. And we all need to get involved. We cannot leave it. Can't leave politics, the politicians. We can't just assume that some experts will solve it for us, because their expertise is the wrong kind of expertise. And we are quite often, many of us, have a kind of expertise which we need to make sure now is listened to. But also, we have to get our hands dirty. There's no two ways about it. We have to really get in. You know, I even created in a one-issue party once in Sweden. I was so upset during the Bosnian War was going on. I created with the actress Bibi Andersson, we created the party called the Sarajevo List, just to make sure that this issue was heard in the first election Sweden had for the European Parliament. Now, you know, we didn't expect to get power or to get in, but we were able to. Nothing politicians fear more than if somebody's going to compete for their vote. So by creating a new political party, we actually had more influence than we would have had if we had just been an NGO making the same demands.
Very interesting. One of the things that we notice with the present system, it seems to devour the future, whereas indigenous peoples have respect for their ancestors of the past. And they always are thankful to their ancestors because they have this affiliation to the land, whereas, of course, today's business model just bulldozes across the land. We have in New Zealand Pauline Tangiora, who is our Maori representative, or the Maori representative for the World Future Council.
Well, you know, obviously we have 50 councillors and we try to be globally representative. Well, you know, we have 50 councillors from all over the world. We try to have all the continents represented, different walks of life. We have representatives from governments, from parliament, from civil society, from business and from the sciences. So obviously the fact that there are two councillors from New Zealand means that they are both very outstanding individuals. And Pauline Tangiora is a Maori elder. She is a global indigenous leader. She is the only indigenous representative on the World Future Council, which I think sort of shows something also about the vibrancy of Maori culture. Yeah, that the only indigenous leader on the World Future Council and this global organization is a Maori. I think it's very true what you say about the respect for the past, but also the respect for the future. If you look at the situation in, I know from West Africa, for example, where I was told that every village is inhabited by these sort of three generations, those who lived before, and you involve them in the decision-making by respecting traditions, and then there are those here now, and then there are future generations whose interests also have been considered. And, of course, in the indigenous people in North America did this through the seventh generation principle. Every decision had to be considered. Its impact on the seventh coming generation had to be considered. Now, you know, we now live in a world where our decisions even affect geological time frames. When you look at nuclear waste and other issues, and the climate, you know, once you destabilize the climate, how long will it take to stabilize it again? It's interesting, when the Club of Rome made their predictions about limits to growth, they were most concerned about non-renewable resources, how far they would run out. And sometimes they were right, and sometimes they were off by a few decades, but it doesn't matter because we didn't listen to their warnings. What they totally underestimated was the wasteful way we would deal with renewable resources. Soil erosion has progressed much faster than the Club of Rome predicted. And the climate, of course, I mean, the ultimate renewable resource. They didn't even dream of the fact that we would destabilize the global climate to the extent we're now done. And this is, you know, the speeding up now to such an extent that what we thought would be an issue for our great-grandchildren has suddenly become an issue not just for our children, but for us.
I am speaking with Jacob von Ixkill of the World Future Council. Yes, because I'd like to talk about climate change and particularly global warming. We have the Manufacturers Federation and also the Federated Farmers here in New Zealand who still refrain from acknowledging global warming is a challenge. Your information about global warming is such.
The evidence for global warming, or as I call it, climate chaos, is just overwhelming that the people who refuse to recognize it are just hiding away from what Al Gore very, you know, reasonably calls an inconvenient truth. It is for people who are part of the problem, who are causing it through their activities, it is an extremely inconvenient truth. But, you know, the fact is the UN consensus was accepted even by the Bush administration in the US, by Saudi Arabia, by Russia. These are the declarations of the IPCC, of the UN climate panel, and they are pretty apocalyptic. Now, the reality, if you listen to the world's top climate scientists, is even more serious. Things are progressing faster. Even the pessimistic projections of 3, 4, 5 years ago are turning out to be too optimistic. So, yes, it's understandable. You know, there are people who believe in a flat earth. There are people who always have put their, you know, heads in the sand. I mean, there are people, you know, and quite influential people, you know, some months before the Second World War began, were ridiculing Winston Churchill and saying, oh, you know, he's been talking about the Nazi Germany, you know, beginning a world war, beginning a war, you know, now for I don't know how many years, and look, it still hasn't happened. We're still in peace. And, you know, a few weeks later it came. And so, of course, the same thing is going to happen, you know, with these people. But the problem is that it still may be too late. I mean, Churchill came at the last minute, and Britain was completely unprepared. You know, they had to get cannons out of museums. And without Roosevelt's support, and he has to convince the American people, fascism would have won. And the same thing, if we allow climate chaos to win, unfortunately, the effects will last much more than a fascist victory in Europe had lasted. But morally, it's the same thing. I mean, to really try to sort of prevent action against global warming, to refuse to see the facts, It's like people who are refused, who keep the lights on during blackouts during war. It's a totally immoral and despicable position. There's no, you know, it's like Holocaust denial. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Some years ago, you could still argue, oh, well, the evidence isn't there. The evidence is completely overwhelming. And the problem is that there are people who, for personal reasons, are profiting from the current system, refuse to change, and those who could profit from the changes, which we now need, because they are huge. I mean, we need to rebuild our whole industrial society. We need to rebuild our ways of production, of consumption, probably the greatest entrepreneurial opportunity of all times. But, you know, the problem is many people who call themselves entrepreneurs are really just protectors of privilege. And they, as we see now with the banks and so, you know, they like to live off state subsidies. They like the profits to be corporatized while all the costs, you know, go to the public. And this is, as I said, it's a despicable position. It's not a credible position. If you look at the evidence, none of these climate skeptics who deny the reality of global warming have been able to publish a single article in a peer-reviewed scientific magazine for 10, 15, 20 years. So it's ridiculous. But of course, as I said, you know, it's an inconvenient truth. And unfortunately, those businessmen, those entrepreneurs who are part of the solution, they are being prevented from implementing these solutions by these huge subsidies, by this power which is still flowing to people who are part of the problem. And I think it's extremely disappointing to see the position the New Zealand government is taking here, how it's sort of backtracking on the commitments, because, you know, New Zealand has this reputation of being a country which is in the forefront of protecting the environment, of standing for a pure environment, and suddenly to find it now taking such outrageous positions. I know even some New Zealand businessmen are very unhappy about it, and I just do hope that the pressure on the government here will grow so that they again are in the forefront, and New Zealand is seen as a country which is part of the future, not part of the past.
I agree with you, definitely. How do we bring on the youth? How do we ignite the youth to be involved? A lot of people are taking a lot of time sitting in front of television.
Well, I know many young people who are extremely active. We had the World Future Council worked with children. We had an organization called Kids Call, and we asked school children, sort of ages between 10 and 18, to write letters, which we then promised to hand over to the G8 leaders at their sort of global economic summits. And we got about 14,000 letters within a couple of months. And it's interesting, the younger children, sort of 10 to 14, 15, they are very concerned about biodiversity loss, about the species extinction. The older ones were very critical of consumerism. And it is interesting that although we are told that this is the future and, you know, this is what people want, when you listen to young people, and especially you go to international youth conferences, they're extremely critical of this whole global model, the idea that the greatest goal for society is to expand consumer choice. This does not really interest them. When they see the cost, especially when they see the cost, it interests them even less. So there were demands for, you know, commerce-free space. And interesting enough, even the large Brazilian city of São Paulo, 2 years ago they had a referendum, and they banned all outdoor advertising as visual pollution. So there are some changes that are happening quite rapidly. And so we found many young people are very engaged. What surprised our researchers who went through these 14,000 letters was how polite they were. They said they are very concerned, but when they write to these prime ministers, it's still, they're very polite. Now, I think maybe we also need more anger from young people, because what is happening is really foreclosing their future. And so we started another project in the World Future Council called Future Justice, where we are saying, how can you create taboos, because a society without taboos, you see, collapses. But if taboos aren't enough, how can you criminalize some of these future foreclosing activities? And there are clear examples. If you allow bottom trawling, you are killing off the young fish, there won't be any fish left anymore for our children and grandchildren. So these are activities which, although economically profitable in the short term, really are crimes against the future. You could look at destabilizing the climate, I'm sure some, you know, nuclear weapons, there are a number of examples like that. And so we had meetings with international judges and prosecutors at the International Criminal Court and other courts in The Hague to see how can you criminalize such activities. And there was a lot of interest that it's not going to happen very soon. But even bringing this into the public debate causes a lot of attention. I know if maybe you don't even need to actually prosecute these people if you can create taboos, if you can make sure that something which threatens the future is taboo. And, you know, our ancestors, they had destroying the drinking water, poisoning the well. It was a capital crime. And today we find that, you know, chemical industries can do things like that. The churches seem too weak. They don't even, why don't they excommunicate some of these polluters? It is remarkable to having the churches talk about morality all the time and focusing on personal morality, but not on the kind of morality which is threatening God's creation. You know, it's interesting that there's obviously many people in the Christian movement who are still very allied with, you know, conservative political forces, but there are more and more, and even in the United States, you know, who are concerned with what they call creation care, who are outraged by what is being done, how we are polluting, how we are destroying, threatening God's creation.
Very true. With the internet, lots of people say this is our only tool in many cases to cooperate and work together. How do you see this bringing people together to galvanize us to take action?
Well, it's a tool, but it's not the solution. If you use it to galvanize people to take action, yes. But when people start thinking that it's enough if I sign a petition on the internet, then of course it isn't enough. You know, when they had the big, just before the Iraq war began in London, there was this huge demonstration with 2 million people marching, and then they all went home. And I'm sure if just, you know, 20,000 of those, 1%, had stayed on, if they had sort of, you know, blockaded Whitehall, if they had been prepared to be inconvenience themselves for a couple of days, for a couple of weeks, the government would have caved in. But today, unfortunately, most activism seems to be just happen on the internet. And so, as I said, you know, internet is a tool to mobilize people, but the old-fashioned way of going out there, getting involved in politics, going and, you know, talking to your member of parliament, civil disobedience, that is still the way, and we can see that in many countries, how you actually affect real political change. You do not affect real political change only by internet petitions.
Jacob, how do you see the future unfolding from a positive sign? How would you like to see it all happen?
Well, I see, as I said before, that there are these solutions. And so if you work to spread them, if you make sure that you have the right laws and regulations, if you make sure that people who are part of the solution don't find themselves blockaded, threatened, marginalized, but find themselves supported by the institutions of society, then changes can happen very, very rapidly. You know, when the wall fell 6 months before the Berlin Wall fell, none of the political elite, and I know this because I was a member of the European Parliament then, expected anything like that. They didn't expect the status of Berlin to change. So things, first of all, change can be very, very rapid. In times of crisis, big steps are often easier to take than small steps, because big steps are seen as adequate, as realistic vis-a-vis the problem, as problem realistic, and therefore you can mobilize people, you can enthuse people for big steps, while small steps is, you know, why should I waste my time, it's not going to help anyway. And what can be done? We need, first of all, I think it's important to remember that the greatest waste, daily waste, the greatest destruction of capital is the destruction of our natural capital by not maximizing the use of renewable energy. Because, you know, we need energy for so many things, and we have an abundance. Al Gore said that, you know, 40 minutes of sunshine is enough to provide the energy for the planet for a whole year. Obviously, you can't do that one-to-one. But it is clear that, you know, we don't have to worry. We don't need to go back to the Stone Age. We have an abundance of energy, which we are wasting every day, because the sunshine of today, the wind of today, cannot be used anymore tomorrow. But because of narrow, petty and economic calculations, which calculate only the extraction costs and say, oh, you know, the extraction costs of solar energy is still more than of oil. But in the comparison, it's ridiculous. The oil which you've used is gone forever. The solar energy which you haven't used is gone forever. So the two are completely opposite. And so once we start understanding that, once we start having new indicators of costs, once we start looking at, you know, not just at the bottom line, but because the bottom line depends on what we include in the top lines, and once we make sure that the costs are also included in the top lines, we are going to find that there are many things we can do, because whatever we can do, we can finance. There's no lack of money in the world. That's ridiculous. You have the resources, if you have the knowledge, if you have the technology, if you have the will, you can do it. Therefore, I think once we get out of this paralysis, which tells us, first of all, sorry,
it's too expensive, who's going to pay for it? Which is basically saying, oh, sorry, it's too expensive to live on this planet, because it's what we're talking about. Then I think you can mobilize people, just like Roosevelt did when fascism threatened. The U.S. population was mobilized. They reduced the training times to shipbuilders from 4 years to 7 weeks, and they produced these 100,000 Big Liberty ships, which were able to basically save the U.K., save Russia, prevent fascism from winning. They produced over 300,000 airplanes. When Roosevelt started telling the American captains of industry what he needed, they said, it's impossible. And he said, well, I give you 10 days to come back with a plan how to do it. And they did. You can mobilize people for rapid change very, very quickly. We need this now. The solutions are there. There's no lack of money. We just need a sort of a shift in our thinking, and we just need to push, make sure that the push for change becomes stronger than the inertia of the defenders of privilege. Of course, there's going to be a lot of rethinking done, but every person can decide every day to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. And who knows, the famous saying about the snowflake which breaks the twig, the drop which makes the cup flow over. We don't know if it's going to be us. It may be just an individual. It may be one of your listeners who can make the crucial difference. I've seen this so many times, how one individual can, you know the story about how, you know, the end of the Vietnam War, these Pentagon papers, these secret Pentagon papers were published, and there was such an outrage in the U.S. population that the government, the president, had to end the war in Vietnam. Now, what happened? Daniel Ellsberg is known, you know, a government scientist, a government advisor who had access to these secret papers. He published them. What was the defining moment which made him decide to publish them? Well, he was in a bar in Tokyo once, coming back from Vietnam, and he met this American poet, and there were these only two Americans in this bar in Tokyo, and they talked all night, and this poet was very much opposed to the war, and this discussion left such a deep impression on Ellsberg that after thinking about it for many months, he sent a message to this poet, once, then received a message saying, this discussion we had almost a year ago in Tokyo changed my life, and watched the papers in the next few days. So, you know, I say to people, even a meeting you have in a bar may end a war. I mean, there are many examples of this, of what one individual could do. You know, we see it with the Right Livelihood Awards. One individual could stop the ex-dictator from returning, you know. So we are incredibly powerful. We just have to use our power.
Also, the World Future Council has a spiritual component. How do you bring the faith or the spiritual qualities within people to blossom, to allow us to see we're all humans, we all need to cooperate, and we can, together?
Well, very challenging, because many people see religion as part of the problem, and of course religious institutions have been part of the problem, and also they are not very keen to often to be part of the solution. There are some religious leaders who are quite outstanding. You know, the head of the Orthodox Church, Patriarch Bartholomew, he has called together since about 10 years now or more a symposia, call them the RSE Religion, Science and Environment Symposia, where they go on a ship for a week to 10 days through some threatened sea or ocean or down a river. Scientists, environmentalists, religious leaders, and he tries to, you know, get them together and become more active. So there are good people like that also within the religious establishment. But to me, it is overwhelmingly we are still sort of stuck, because we are not ready to recognize that this materialistic, mechanistic worldview is very much part of the problem. If you believe that the material is the ultimate reality, then I guess in order to realize yourself, you need to accumulate as many material possessions as possible. But if you feel that you're part of a larger, intelligent, living universe, then I think you have a different perspective to material things, which doesn't mean that you just want to live in poverty like a monk or a nun. It just means that you have other priorities than maximizing the choice of consumer goods. You have different priorities. You certainly wouldn't want to risk the future of your children. You know, you have I think there's one common human value which is shared by all, which is this deeply felt obligation, I call it the birth instinct, to hand over a better world, or at least not a world in a worse state, to our children than, you know, what we have found ourselves. So I think there is a spiritual component there. There is a feeling that we, as I said, we are part of this larger, living, intelligent whole. And beyond that, I think it expresses itself in very many different ways. And so I just wanted inside the World Future Council also to have this debate, to have this debate on values and ethics, but to move further than that and see in how far this mechanistic, materialistic
scientific view which has been imposed upon us has contributed to the problem we are facing, and I'm convinced it has. My grandfather was a biologist, but he was very critical of this worldview. So you can be a scientist, a very very good scientist, and still reject this mechanistic, materialistic view of ultimate nature, and feel that we don't understand everything. You know, the idea that just because we have to come up with some simplistic explanation. Because we don't understand what is this interconnectedness. But it's quite clear that to many people it's very deep and it's very strong. It's quite clear that, you know, this sort of the rediscovery that, you know, there is a holiness in the world. There are things which we respect not just for utilitarian reasons, but because we feel that there is some deeper sense there, the connectedness we feel with our ancestors, with future generations. That to me is what is spiritual. I think it can be expressed in many, many different ways. But this deeply felt obligation to preserve a healthy planet for future generations, I think that unites us all.
So there's a unity. We're working always towards unity and diversity.
Yes, I mean, this is, I think, also a very important point, because quite often people say, well, what's your model then? You know, we have this global model of globalization, and you know, we have this one explanation. What's your explanation? I say, well, I think there are many explanations and there are many models, and this diversity is crucial. And so there is not one counter model to the current ruling model, because one of the main problems, maybe the main problem with the current model, is trying to impose one model on the whole planet, one model of economics, you know, one sort of belief system, one political model. And that clearly is not going to work. And I think the ascendance now of Asia, and there's a lot of naivety about the optimism which, you know, comes out of some of these Asian thinkers. I mean, they certainly have not integrated the environmental threat, the climate threat, because, again, it's a very, very inconvenient truth for them. Because why shouldn't they have the right to have living standards like in New Zealand or in Germany, in the USA? Well, they may have the right, but the problem is if they all had it tomorrow, it would be the end of the biosphere. But unless we change, they're not going to change. So, you know, we need to create a mature debate with them too. We need to see that, yes, there are certain rights which they have because we have now created this model, but it's impossible for us all to live like that. So how can you rapidly make sure that they change? How can you make sure rapidly that there is change, that countries like China and India move to, you know, renewable energies, for example, because if they're going to exploit all the coal there in China, well, again, you know, it's going to destroy China. And the Chinese leaders understand this, you know, not just going to destroy the rest of the world. Even if China continues on the present development path, Chinese CO2 emissions alone are enough to make large parts of China uninhabitable. And this is a huge challenge, because how can you speed up this transition to renewable energy so quickly? 100-fold, maybe 1,000-fold wind energy, solar energy. We don't know. There are some rare metals there which are being used in solar. In wind energy, already these big rotors, these big generators, which are being produced now with the present pace of development in the United States, they are finding they're causing major traffic problems. If you want to speed that up 100-fold, because, you know, there are such huge transports, trucks going around with transporting these all over the United States, well, you may need to sort of produce more of them regionally or locally. But there is a huge challenge there. But it's not insurmountable, but it means that we need to rethink. We need to basically rethink everything we're doing, and every law, every regulation, every international agreement, every institution, every production process needs to be rethought and, when necessary, changed from this perspective that the greatest top priority we have is to protect our future and preserve our future, and not to maximize the global production and variety of consumer goods.
And there's an urgency.
Well, the urgency is of course, the greatest problem of all, because we have wasted 35 years. You know, the Club of Rome told us the truth. And largely, overwhelmingly, they were right. And we, therefore, time now for an orderly transition, it's too late for that. It's going to be very disorderly transitions. All we can do is to try to make it as orderly as possible. But it is going to be a huge challenge, but also a very, very exciting challenge.
Thank you, Jacob. Superb. I greatly appreciate you coming in and sharing with New Zealanders.
Thank you so much.
That was Jacob von Exgal of the World Future Council at www.worldfuturecouncil.org. He is also the instigator of the Right Livelihood Awards, the alternative Nobel Prize, annually presented in the Swedish Parliament, and you can find his website, rightlivelihood.org.